For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, J.M. Joseph introduces us to Fireboy, a superhero whose superpowers come with unfortunate side effects. Dave Steele shares the latest chapters of his life as the blind poet, including plans for a series of children's stories. Tendai Huchu introduces us to the hairdresser of Harare, and Anjali Q. Ralph mixes light and dark in her new book, The Star Outside My Window. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Fireboy is a flamingly funny book from a brand new author. It's a story of friendship, Inca legends, and a cat named Lemon. My interest was kindled. So I fired off an email, and Jay lit up the studio on his arrival. J.M. Joseph, welcome to Read On.
It's lovely to be here, Red. Thank you very much.
So for those who haven't yet read Fireboy, tell us a little bit about the story.
Fireboy is a novel for 8 to 12-year-olds, and I like to think of it as a comic adventure. It's a story about a boy, Aiden, who gets a parcel through the post one day. It's top secret, doesn't know who sent it to him, and when he opens it, he finds a jar of sweets. And, of course, he opens these, and he shares them with his friends, Sadie and Hussein, and then develops powers. And then, in many respects, the rest of the novel is the consequences of these, what happens to it, who sent the parcel, and it goes on from there.
And they get some terrific powers, but not necessarily the ones we might expect. Hussein can make anything electronic do his bidding, and Sadie can move things through psychokinesis, but Aiden gets a really weird power, doesn't he?
That's right. He can ignite, and when he's totally on fire, he can fly, although he's not very good at it because he's a little frightened of trying to do it. The idea behind it was that they get this jar called Nature's Owns, and it's supposed to come from an ancient Inca sacred tree that gives powers, and the powers themselves are supposed to be to release, if you like, the potential within you. So Sadie is very powerful, she is very clever, Hussein is very much into computers and gaming, and Aiden, as his name means, fire, and is impulsive. So the idea is the powers reflect what they can do.
There's a kind of element of the Incredible Hulk about this, isn't there, that Aiden isn't harmed by the fire when
No.
he comes back to normal, but his garments don't necessarily survive.
No, unlike the Hulk's amazing shorts, which tend to reduce when he returns back to Bruce Banner, Aiden, if he's in his school clothes, say, and burns up, they can't survive. So it creates somewhat social embarrassing situations, I think is the best way to put it. And it's very much a comedy. I think the idea is, I grew up reading comic books, Spider-Man. I grew up in America in the 70s when the Marvel was at its golden age in many respects. And so they meant a lot to me. But when you see them today, everyone takes them very serious. And what I used to like about the old Marvel comics when Stan Lee was doing a lot of the writing was how funny they were, kind of wiry. Now, they were pitched, of course, at teenagers and maybe a little bit older than the children I'm aiming at. So what I try to do is to look at the fact that having these superpowers isn't necessarily easy. They cause complications. It isn't just, you know, up, up and away, and just trying to look at the real effects of perhaps having one, but in a very much a comedy sort of manner.
Well, it is great fun. It's laugh out loud. I also learnt a bit about the Incas. You're clearly quite fascinated by their history. Is it something that you have studied in the past?
Well, I know a lot of mythology. I was quite interested in the idea of the sun god and those sorts of aspects of it. And when you're trying to look for a kind of plausible reason, that seemed the best thing for me in terms of coming up with how could you have this. And in the future books, the idea of the environment, because it takes place in the Peruvian cloud forest, we'll come into it a bit more in books 2 and 3.
I was going to ask if there were going to be sequels. So presumably you've been giggling your way through plotting them and writing them.
Yeah, pretty much. I would like to think the next one is a long book 2, if you like. It'll be part 1 and part 2, whereas this one was pretty much a straight one-off.
Right. And you've had quite an adventurous life yourself. You've travelled from the United States via Ireland to here. Do you see common threads in the mythology of North America, Ireland and Britain?
Well, I used to read a lot of Joseph Campbell when I was young. Mm. He talked about a mono myth and how many of the mythologies say the story of the hero are across all mythologies. And I think there's a lot of substance to that. If you look at the local variations, you'll find them a bit different. So probably the best way to answer that. Certainly Native American mythologies differ from tribe to tribe. So it's very hard to come up with one that you would say equates to, say, the Irish myths of Deirdre and the rest of their heroes. I think when it comes to mythology today, a lot of the comic books for young children, the heroes now, when you see them on screen, in many respects, are these new gods, for good or bad, in the terms of having superpowers who can come down from, say, Olympus, although here it'll be Tony Stark's building, and deliver vengeance or justice and get up to the same sort of hijinks and failures that the Greek gods did long ago.
And, of course, all those myths and legends are from the oral tradition, and you have got an audiobook version of Fireboy coming out. Was it important that you should reach as wide an audience of people who might possibly be print disabled?
Absolutely. For me, I've been a teacher for most of my career, and reading books and sharing them with classes has been one of my greatest pleasures. So I wanted very much to have the story version, I think, to reach out to people, to be able to hear it, to listen to it, adds a different flavor to it. I know myself with my children listening to story tapes when my grandmother had diabetes late on in life, and so she struggled to read, and talking books and the like were very important to her. So yes, I would love to think that talking books, the audible version, will get out to as many listeners as possible.
Were you tempted to narrate it yourself?
No. Aidan Sweeney is a native Londoner, and I don't sound like a native Londoner. I can do a few voices, but not Aidan's. I think perhaps I need someone a little bit more hip.
Right. And your children are middle grade sort of age as well, are they? Are they reading the same kind of books as Fireboy?
My children are all grown, though. I have very good memories of reading to them when they were younger. But I still teach year 6, year 7, and 8, and I have spent most of my time teaching children between the ages of 7 and 13.
Have you done much for World Book Day this year? Did you get dressed up as Dumbledore?
Where I work, we tend to do our World Book Days early on in the year. So we have a big book day, which is combined with two schools. So for World Book Day, we tend to focus more on just reading rather than dressing up.
And what were the books that inspired you as a child? You say that you read the comics, but were you devoted to the Hardy Boys mysteries?
Or? Yes, it's funny you say that. I was a big collector of the Hardy Boys. Yes, we had a lot of those. My sister had Nancy Drew back in those days when gender was split along different lines. But I read all sorts of books. Comics were one thing. When I think of the childhood books that stood out for me, I know Huckleberry Finn was a book that made a big impression on me. I realize now today in 2020 it's a little more problematic for its language, but I know when I read it, thinking of his first sort of mature book I read as a child, having a main character, Huck, speaking in his own voice and standing up for Joe, the runaway slave, and making a decision to suffer the consequences, that to do it right was the most important thing, and that was to help him, meant a great deal to me. I found that very inspiring, and still do that little speech where he decides he'd rather go to hell than turn him in.
Well, J.M. Joseph, I hope people are going to be reading Fireboy and its sequels for many, many years to come. Thank you so much for coming into the studio and being a guest on Read On, and I wish you all the very best of luck.
Thank you very much, Red. It's been a pleasure being here.
Four phrases, in no particular order, that best describe Sadie Laurel Hewitt, aged 12. Tall, long-haired, quick to smile, skilled at football, piano, dance and kickboxing. Youngest daughter of the film and television actor Alice Laurel. Speaks four languages. Unrivaled in board games involving planning, word skills or precision. Day student at Lady Pandora's School for Girls and fellow resident of Alexandria Apartments. Sadie pointed to the llama stamp. This was posted in Peru. How curious. Are you going to open it or wait until your mum comes home? Waiting had never crossed my mind. My only worry was Granny. At any minute, the she-bear might stumble out of her bed cave. If she did, I could kiss this parcel goodbye. Granny would snatch it away, and what would I be left with? A stiff wallop over the head for daring to answer the door.
Neil Gardner,
narrating Fireboy by my guest J.M. Joseph, available commercially wherever you buy your books. And Jay will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we meet the hairdresser of Harare, and Anjali Q. Ralph tells us about two new stories to enjoy over the Easter holidays. But first, Dave Steele's life has gone through some momentous changes in the 6 years since he lost his sight. The enormous international success of his three volumes of poetry, Stand By Me, RP, has given voice to the thoughts and feelings of thousands of us who live with sight loss every day, and it's helped those around us to understand what it's like. The book's success has taken Dave on quite a journey. Most recently, he was selected by the American Foundation of the Blind to host their annual Helen Keller Award in Washington. This interview was recorded the day before the AFB postponed the event due to coronavirus. But as you'll hear, the blind poet has plenty of other irons in the fire. Dave Steele, the blind poet, welcome back onto RNIB Connect Radio.
It's good to be back.
So, for those who don't know about the Helen Keller Award, tell us a bit about it. It's very prestigious.
Certainly is. So it's been going for 24 years now. And previous winners have been the likes of Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, some big organisations, the likes of Apple. And yeah, it's a very prestigious award celebrating all that's good within the sight loss community.
And you're the first British person ever to have been asked to present it.
Yeah, it's a massive honour, and I cannot wait to get over there and get started. It's going to be a fantastic night, and yeah, I'm very humbled and honoured to have this opportunity.
It's a very, very long way that you've come in the last 6 years. Can you quite believe it?
It's crazy. My wife has got to the stage where there's that many crazy things happening with this journey that I seem to be on that nothing surprises her anymore, and it's sort of the way with me. I knew when this journey started that it was going to change everything from where I was at back then, but the doors that it's opening and the opportunities that I'm getting are certainly incredible.
And just to go back to that, your diagnosis came pretty much out of the blue. It knocked you for six, and your way of coping with it was to start this wonderful trilogy of volumes of poetry, Stand By Me, RP, that's brought so much hope and understanding to so many people who've got sight loss and to their families. Give us a little bit of background to that.
So I was diagnosed officially with RP in April 2014. Myself and my wife, I just proposed and we had a six-month-old baby boy. I was in kind of a new cycle of a new part of my life. A new beginnings, a lot of us go through, and went for a routine eye test. Used to get myself checked every couple of years because I knew I had retinitis pigmentosa in my family because it comes from my mum's side, and I've got my mum that's got it, and two of my sisters have got it as well. And used to get myself checked just to make sure I was still okay for driving and things like that. And went in for a routine eye test, and they looked in the back of my eyes, and they said, the pigment's really, really thick there. There's been a really dramatic change in your vision. You need to stop driving straight away. I told my employer, I was working in car sales at the time and I was working as a singer, and my job had to let me go because I could no longer drive. And that started a year of really, really struggling, going through a lot of the things that people with a new diagnosis of low vision tend to go through. About a week after that initial appointment, I was declared severely sight impaired, which is legally blind these days, and we struggled to get the help we need. You applied for things like personal independence payment. There was a 9-month waiting list for that. We struggled to feed our family, had to feed our kids on food parcels while we were tied up in the system, lost the house because we couldn't afford the rent on the place that we were staying at, and things were really, really dark for a little while. And my sister, who was the first to be diagnosed, suggested that I go onto some of the support groups on Facebook and speak to people who were going through the same thing, and that's where it all changed. I got invited to a support group, and because they'd heard I worked as a singer, they asked me if I'd be the entertainment for the day. So the night before the event, I was in bed and in quite a dark place, struggling with anxiety and depression and all the usual things, loss of independence, loss of confidence. The biggest thing was a loss of purpose. I didn't know what I was going to do next. I was lost altogether. And I was going over ideas of songs to perform the following day at this support group. And I had this idea where I thought it'd be great thing to take a song that everyone knew but change the words, so it would have more of an emotional response, more of an impact. So I chose Stand By Me by Benny King, because I like the opening line of When the Night Has Come and the Land Is Dark and the Moon Is the Only Light We'll See, because that was like night blindness, which is the first stages of RP. So I rewrote the songs. The words just came to me. It took me about 20 minutes to write a couple of new verses, change the chorus about, performed it the following day. And as soon as I performed that song and saw the response in the audience, I knew that that was going to be the start of a new journey and something that was going to change the way I felt and change everything in my life. And that's what happened. People were saying to me that I was able to describe how they felt about their blindness or their low vision, and it was helping them feel like they were less alone. And that sparked something inside me where I started to write poetry and music, because to me, lyrics and poetry are the same thing. And it just started spilling out of me to the point where now, was it nearly 6 years later, I've written over 700 poems, 3 books, and now I speak at events all over the world. And it just literally all started with that song.
And that's the song that you are going to start this year's Helen Keller Awards with. But not just you and your guitar this time.
Basically, we've got a guitarist and a pianist that's going to back me with it. But it's going to be a really emotional moment, opening the event with that song that sparked everything for me. And the reason why I named the book Stand By Me RP, and it went from there, it was the beginning of my journey, but it's really developed a lot from there. And I'm very proud of where the books have gone to and where these words go to and the amount of people that have helped in those early stages or when they're just having a bad day.
You are reaching an international audience. The fact that you have been asked to present these awards is a reflection of just what a wide audience you're reaching. And this all came about because you were doing a book tour of the States last year, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. One of my followers, a lady by the name of Barb Calhoun, who has Usher syndrome, so she's deafblind, she was helped by one of my poems from my first book and started paying attention to the poetry and using it to help her and sharing it with other people. And through the connections of people that she knew in America, we organised my first book tour, and I went out in October last year. I toured the East Coast, speaking at events for different charities and sight loss organisations, and then had meet and greets where I'd do book signings and basically tell my story and read some poetry that related to those particular moments in my life. And it was an incredible response. I do events over here in the UK. I'm an ambassador for Henshaw's, and I do different charities and organisations here in the UK. But in America, it was just completely another level of response.
Having read your poetry myself, it expresses so much that I find it so difficult to put into words, and it's just as much about communicating what life with RP or any form of sight loss is like to those who can see as to expressing one's own feelings, isn't it?
Absolutely. The two big factors spurring me on and the driving force behind everything I do is helping people in those early stages. And you know, everyone has bad days, doesn't matter how far you are progressing in this journey. In anything in life, we have bad days. So helping those kind of people through that poetry, because poetry, as I said, is music, and we all have maybe a particular song that spoke to us in our past where maybe it's gotten us through a teenage heartbreak or something like that. And that's the power of poetry and music. It has that ability to heal the heart and touch the soul in different ways. But also, as you rightly said there, it's also about breaking down those misconceptions. There's far too many people out there that are held back because of the common misconceptions of blindness. Most people out there think you're either completely blind or you're not at all. I have a lot of people will say to me, oh, I'm not blind enough to use a cane yet, or I'm not blind enough to apply for a guide dog yet. And I'll say to them, well, do you find yourself not going out to certain places because of your low vision, or are you struggling in low light situations and you find yourself isolating more? And they say, yeah. And I say, well, you're ready then. But because they don't fit in that perceived box of apparently what blindness is supposed to look like, they've all heard that, oh, you don't look blind, they stop themselves from taking these steps and using a cane, especially men, because men seem to feel this sense of pride using a cane, like it's a sign of weakness or they're going to be seen as being vulnerable. And I want to show them that actually it's not the case, it's the opposite. For you to take help and use a cane, use a mobility aid and get out there is actually a great sign of strength. And what better way to do that than through poetry? Me standing there and just speaking is one way of being able to get a message across. But when you put in a poem or a piece of music, people really do lean in and listen, and it goes straight to the heart, and that's a great way of getting a message across.
I know that you told me that you're going to close the Helen Keller Awards with a poem that you've written, and you very kindly agreed to read that out on the show. So if that's still okay, can I hand it over to you?
Absolutely. This literally just tells my story and explains the reason why I do what I do as the blind poet. And it goes like this. All the tears that I have shed and these scars upon my wrist have made me who I am today, prepared me now for this. I wouldn't be so strong if I had never failed before. I'd still be isolated, scared to step outside my door. I'm not saying that I'm over this. Those bad eye days still come. But even now, whilst reading this, I'm blinded by the sun. I'm anxious and my chest is tight. I feel like giving in. But deep inside my heart, I know I'll never let this win. I promised just 6 years ago when blindness certified, through poetry I'd share my tale to others far and wide, so no one ever needs to feel alone with losing sight. Explain their thoughts to loved ones through these verses that I write. But never did I imagine that my words could do so much. They've healed the hearts of strangers, opened doors with slightest touch. I'll be a friend, my pride will mend, my purpose clear to see. 3 books will be my legacy, my Stand By Me RP. I know that soon these faces that I look upon today will disappear, but I won't fear, these memories will stay. My wife, my sons, my daughter, in here will never age. My love for them is printed in each poem, verse and page. When laughter's gone, I'll carry on to make my family proud, to be a voice for others, to help them lift this hazy shroud, inspire them to grab a cane and step outside their homes. 4 words, each poem's message, saying you are not alone.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dave. For anyone who wants to buy any or all of the Stand By Me RP volumes of poetry, they can go to your website or they can find them on Amazon.
That's correct. Yeah, they can go to the website, which is theblindpoet.net, and you can get them on Amazon as well at Stand By Me RP volumes 1-3. And obviously there's a new book series coming out soon, which is going to be a series of children's books as well.
I want to come on to discuss that. I know if people go to the website, they can find some pretty funky merchandise as well.
Yeah. We've got a whole array of merchandise on there, from baseball caps and T-shirts and mouse mats and some rather unusual stuff as well there. It's been created by the American management. Shower curtains and bath mats.
Excellent. Well, you know, anybody who's looking for birthday or Christmas ideas, there you go. So tell us about this really exciting departure into children's books.
Last year on World Book Day, the British author Julia Donaldson had come out and she said that we need to have more children with disabilities featured in children's stories, because there's a great lack of it there and a lack of understanding, and many children with disabilities in mainstream schools are left out of peer social groups through children not being educated enough, that children with disabilities are literally just like them, they're just children with different challenges. So I had this idea to do a short story poetry book series based on a child with low vision. I wanted to use my son, Austin, who's now 6, because with my RP, there's a 1 in 2 chance that my children will lose their sight when they're older. And that's another big inspiration for me, to show them all the things that you can still do despite these challenges of low sight. So I wanted to use Austin as the main character. We have a guide dog in there as well. He's got a little guide dog, and it's about him going to school and all the challenges that he faces on a day-to-day basis. And it's about helping children with disabilities and low vision in particular have a character to identify with, but also helping other children who are not necessarily impacted by any kind of disabilities to understand better these children are just like them, and to break down those kind of social barriers. So it's all short poetic stories, and it's once again using poetry to get that message across in the way that Julia Donaldson does brilliantly with her stories, which I read to my son.
And like Julia Donaldson, you have got a fantastic illustrator on board as well.
I certainly have. She's called Sue Green. She's a primary school teacher from Birmingham. She was recommended to me by a guy called Gavin Neat. He was a guide dog trainer himself. He runs a tech firm called Neatbox, who have this amazing app called the Welcome App, and he's a real pioneer in accessibility tech design. He suggested Sue. She really understood the project and the illustrations she's done of Austin. And also, we've used my guide dog, Christopher, as the guide dog in the story. And she's captured them absolutely brilliant. And what a great legacy to, once again, to be able to leave for my children.
Well, I know you're just starting negotiations with publishers. So I hope you'll come back onto the show and tell us all about them.
Absolutely. Yeah,
and maybe even read them.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I could do one now for you if you want.
Oh, go on. Yeah, give us a taste. That would be brilliant.
This is one of the later stories after the world is kind of set up, and it talks about how Austin, as a child with low vision, really uses his imagination to create this dream world for himself. And it goes like this. One of Austin's favorite things to do was to write stories in his head, sometimes daydreaming through a window or fighting pirates from his bed. He'd paint in vivid colors from the sights he once had seen. The seas were blue and dragons were the brightest shade of green. Though when awake, the view he'd take was a tunnel shade of gray, Austin's imagination would make each play the brightest day. No vision loss could gloss over the dreams that he could dream, that anything was possible, no limits to the theme. For this important lesson, Austin never would forget, a dream can make reality a future far from set. So paint it bold till gray and old, and never question why. Just close your eyes, imagine wide, and float into the sky.
Absolutely brilliant. Well, you heard it here on Read On First. Dave Steele, thank you so much for introducing us to the world of Austin. And
you're welcome
for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio again. And it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Appreciate it, Red. Thanks very much for having me. Take care, guys.
Thanks as ever to Dave Steele. And do check out his three excellent volumes of poetry, Stand By Me, RP. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Still to come, Anjali Q. Ralph mixes light and dark in her new book, The Star Outside My Window, and J.M. Joseph opens the books of his life. But before that, here's Robert Kirkwood to take us to Zimbabwe via Edinburgh.
I knew there was something not quite right about Dumi the very first time I ever laid eyes on him. The problem was, I just couldn't tell what it was. Thank God for that. There was a time when I was reputed to be the best hairdresser in Harare, which meant the best in the whole country. Amin Ndoro was the fussiest customer to ever grace a salon, and she would not let any ordinary Kia Kia touch her hair. Having sampled all the salons in Harare, and rejected them all, she settled on ours.
Another book that has been produced in accessible format thanks to Publishing Scotland and Skills Development Scotland is The Hairdresser of Harare. And I'm delighted to be joined by both the author and the narrator of the book. First of all, Tendai, tell us about The Hairdresser of Harare.
It's a story I wrote in 2009, which is quite a while back now, about a young single mum trying to make a life for herself and her daughter. And she's a hairdresser, as the title suggests. And along the way, she has her title usurped, her crown usurped by a dashing young man from a wealthy family. And so the story has a lot of socio-political commentary, throwing a bit of scandal, and you have something that is, I hope, pretty funny and shows you a little bit about life in contemporary Zimbabwe.
Did you write it in Scotland?
Yes, I did, in Edinburgh. I've been there while I was a student there, and doing, I'm a podiatrist by profession, and I've been there since 2005, so you can imagine having guys like J.K. Rowling and Alexander McCall Smith there. But somehow I just don't sell as many books as those guys. It doesn't make any sense to me.
But how was it writing about Zimbabwe when you were in Edinburgh?
This is kind of the funny thing. Writing and literature itself is a culture, and in Zimbabwe it's not anywhere near as developed as it would be here. So all of a sudden, while I was living here, I've got access to more books, you know, and as a cultural thing, you've got bookstores, etc., etc. So I feel the atmosphere is more conducive to the creative person. If I was in Zimbabwe, I think I would have a lot more immediate concerns than making fiction.
Now, Emma Clare, you narrated the book. How was it?
It was great. It was something very different than a lot of what I've been working on for RNIB.
How did you find the accents?
Well, when I met Tendai this morning, I commented on that a little bit, in that I can't say I wasn't hired specifically for my Zimbabwean or my Shona accent. What I try to infuse in the characters is the energy of the characteristic and how they be different from each other, as opposed to having the recording be an exciting adventure in Emma Claire's accent adventures. It sounds more like me as I'm speaking right now than it does any particular accent, mostly because if I'd attempted to do any accent like that without extensive training, I think that would just be more embarrassing for everyone involved.
I've listened to a bit of it and I love it. Oh. Absolutely love it.
You're very kind. I was very nervous that I was going to meet you and it would not be that response. So,
now, talking of that, were you nervous when we were listening, when you had a wee audience this morning?
Oh, definitely. I'm very fortunate in that I've been able to work with Chris and Karen in transcription. They're the editors who are in the sort of the recording studio with me. And I've got a great rapport with them and feel very comfortable with them. It's entirely different when you become aware that you've got a bigger audience there, because in a way it's a bit of a performance. It's a performance that can be edited while you're working, but definitely having an author come in is a very different thing. It would be like performing a play in the playwrights there, or putting on clothes that a designer specifically made. And what you really want to do is be able to be truthful to what they've created. And it becomes a bit nerve-wracking when you go, oh my gosh, am I completely not what you'd pictured for this? So that was a bit nerve-wracking.
Each morning I was greeted by Agnes with, "Sissy Vimbai, you're late again. Customers are waiting." Mrs. Kumala's eldest daughter held the keys and opened the shop. I would make a sound like with my lips and walk in without greeting the cow. I hated her. She hated me twice as much. And so long as Mummy wasn't in, there was no need to pretend otherwise. Everyone knew I was the goose that laid the golden eggs. If I left, half the customers would follow me.
Now, Tendai, tell us about your new book.
New ones, it came out and it's just come out in Zimbabwe. It's called The Maestro, The Magistrate and The Mathematician, and it's set in Edinburgh. It's about three Zimbabwean men who are trying to adapt to life in the city. So it's been called by other people a novel of ideas. It's very hard for me to tell you what the central theme is because I've got, you know, life is messy and my book tries to mirror that. But essentially you've got the magistrate who was obviously a powerful man in Zimbabwe. He comes over here and he's having to do menial jobs and he's adapting to that change in social, economical status. You have the maestro who's a white Zimbabwean who can't make a connection with people in this country, and he falls into the world of books and fantasy, and he's trying to discover the meaning of life through literature. And then you have the mathematician who's young from a wealthy background. His name is Farai. And essentially, like any young person, he just goes with the flow of the city, and he has this great hedonistic lifestyle. And eventually, those three storylines collide and come together, and I think that's the most interesting part of the book.
Considering your own background, is part of it autobiographical?
I hesitate to say autobiographical. Obviously, you can't write something that you don't know. However, you still have to take imaginative leaps. So I would, you know, hesitate to say it's fully autobiographical, even though that is pretty fashionable in literature these days, to have this semi-autobiographical books. But I would say, you know, you have to take it with a pinch of salt. It is still, you know, a hyper-reality.
So you were never a Zimbabwean magistrate?
No. Never.
The Hairdresser of Harare, written by Tendai Hutchu and narrated by Emma Claire Brightland, is available from RNIB Talking Books now. And Tendai, if anyone wants to find out more, do you have a web address?
Sure, you can find me on www.tendaihuchu.com. Do I have to spell that?
I think you should.
Okay, it's Tendai Hutchu, that's TendaiHuchu.com. Or you can catch me on Twitter at Tendai Hutchu.
Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Robert. The Hairdresser of Harare, written by Tendai Hutchu and narrated by Emma Claire Brightlin, is available as TB21718. For more information, search the rnib.com website
or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. Now, before we return to hear the books of J.M. Joseph's life, last year we introduced you to Anjali Q. Ralph and her poignant and witty book, The Boy at the Back of the Class. The story's gone on to win hearts and praise from parents and children alike, and now its hero, Ahmet, the most famous refugee boy in the world, is back in a new story written specially for World Book Day. Anjali joined me down the line to continue where we left off. Anjali, welcome back on to Read On.
Hello, hi, thank you for having me back.
It's an absolute pleasure. You've been pretty busy since I last spoke to you.
Just a little bit, yes. Going to school, talking about the book, talking about what's going on in the world, and also writing as much as I can, absolutely.
Tell us a bit about the World Book Day book.
Okay, so the World Book Day book is called The Day We Met the Queen, and it's a kind of mini-story that follows the boy at the back of the class, where we see Ahmet and his friends finally going off to meet the Queen for the afternoon tea that we left them at the end of the boy at the back of the class. So we see them going on a mini-adventure. It's just a story that lasts for almost a day, actually. So it's a day after the life of Ahmet, after he's become the most famous refugee boy in the world. He's off to meet the most famous woman in the world.
But an arch enemy has got different plans.
Oh, yes. So Brendan the bully rears his head in quite a spectacular and quite smelly way. And also there's a teacher that comes back to haunt the children just as they're making their way to the palace. So that's going to be an interesting one for them to have to confront and for them to have to move past.
Well, it sounds great fun. How did you get into working with the World Book Day people?
They invited me through my publishers to write a follow-up short story for World Book Day. I've always loved World Book Day. It's always been the biggest thing at school when I was a child myself. And getting that book token and getting off to go off and actually pick a book out for myself with my token was always a massive big deal in my world. So it was a huge honour when they came forward and asked me if I could write a book for them for this year's World Book Day. So they're the ones that contacted me. I would have hounded them if I knew how, but they came and asked me very kindly to join in.
So who did you dress up as when you were at school for World Book Day?
I have to say that it was mainly Matilda, because when I was a child at school, we didn't have any costumes in the supermarket, or they were quite expensive. So my mum was always, you know, whatever is the cheapest costume that we could do out of everything you have right now. So I would dress up as Matilda, and I'd have a yellow pencil that I'd walk around with and try and move my eyes. That never worked. So that was my main costume for a good couple of years, I think. And then I think one year it was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I painted my face green, but I didn't have any other parts of costumes, and they really knew who I was, which was always a bit interesting.
Now, Ahmet has really caught the public imagination. He's a fabulous character, and I'm certainly hoping that The Day We Met the Queen is not the last book in the series. Do you have plans for more adventures for him?
I have to say that before World Book Day came, I did go to a lot of schools and answer that very same question with the answer that no, there was no plan for a sequel. I wouldn't be writing about Ahmet again. I think, I mean, I'm okay with this little mini story coming out where we kind of pop into his life for a day after we've left him at the boy's back of the class, but I think this will be it. I don't want to go too much into the story. I want to leave that to the imaginations of the readers, and I want to be able to leave that story with an amazing, wonderful array of possibilities.
But people who love your writing can, of course, explore your new book. Could you give us a little bit of an insight into the plot of that, please?
Absolutely. So Star Outside My Window has an amazing young girl at the centre. Her name is Anaya, and she has a younger brother called Noah. And when the book opens up, we see them walking into a foster home. And something quite horrible has happened to them, where they have actually been taken away from their parents. Something quite drastic has happened. And Anaya is an amazing star hunter. She loves the stars. She loves the constellations. So she believes that she needs to help a very specific, very special star out there in the world, which represents for her mother. So they go on an amazing journey with the new foster brothers that she meets in the foster home, and they are trying to do their best to help this amazing star out there that showed itself in the skies. It's basically a story about a star hunter and an amazing young girl who deals with something quite horrible in the most beautiful way.
Again, you've tackled a difficult subject that quite a lot of children do unfortunately have to experience in their lives, but you've done it through the innocent eyes of a child. So any reader can see the effect that it has on a young child to be subject to domestic violence.
Yes, absolutely. So it was a tricky book to write in the sense that I want those who are experiencing domestic violence, and unfortunately the statistics tell us that one in every seven child is seeing abuse in some level at home. So I wanted those children to be able to understand what might have happened to Anaya, but I also wanted those children who aren't going through that to just enjoy the story for the adventure that it is and actually understand and maybe begin to open their eyes as to the fact that there might be children out there who are going through tragedies in their world. Domestic violence and abuse is something that I do feel like we need to talk about. We need to have a platform in which to do that safely with our children without traumatising them. And I'm hoping that the book Starts at My Window will help get discussions going as to what is and what isn't permitted within the home when it comes to relationships, and also helping children overcome these kinds of abuses and helping to understand also what children might be going through and their different realities. I'm really hoping that with that moment those kinds of discussions will start to happen, and I'm hoping also teachers and children aren't afraid to have those discussions with each other. So let's see what happens with that.
And of course the flip side of that is that it is another great fun story. There is a particularly great adventure at the Royal Observatory, which I remember taking my own children to when they were little. Did you get special access to work out how to get in there?
No, I didn't. I actually had all these theories and things, and I was very fortunate. I managed to get in touch with some pretty fantastic volunteers who work at the Royal Observatory, and I had an amazing woman who sneaked me into a kind of open night show where they talk about all of their equipment, and they talk about the stars, etc., and they let me touch the button that pushes a big telescope and makes it revolve around in the globe. So I didn't have special access to any kind of underground tunnels or anything. They don't exist, but I did have some pretty phenomenal people advise me and tell me what would and wouldn't work in the sense of making it as real as possible. So no special access, but some sneaking in was done. Yes, absolutely.
It's good to know you're having a great adventure as well.
Yes. It's always fun to push buttons that move things that you don't expect to be able to move yourself.
And again, you've got a terrific narrator reading the audiobook. It's very important for you that the books are accessible to everyone.
Absolutely. I don't think we can live in a world where we ignore anybody who isn't able to access a story. So I'm really hoping we branch out in more ways as well. So, for example, those with dyslexia or any kind of other conditions that stops them from being able to access a story are helped. So I'm really, really happy that the book's coming out on audio, and hopefully it will come out in other formats as well. So fingers crossed.
Well, fantastic. We will play out with a clip of The Star Outside My Window. Angelique Ralph, thank you so much for being a guest again on Read On, and I look forward to meeting up with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Red. I'm really hungry for the day I get to see you again, so I'll bring the chocolate frogs, I promise.
Wonderful. I can't wait.
Bye.
Even though it's our third day in the foster house, for the first few seconds after I wake up, I forget that Mum is gone and that Dad can't find us, and that I'm not in my room at home anymore. But then my eyes start to see things properly and my brain starts to remember everything, and I wish I hadn't woken up at all. I squeeze my eyes tight shut again and hold on to the silver locket around my neck. I love my locket. It's round and shiny with swirls all over it. Mum and Dad bought it for me for my 7th birthday, and it's the only thing I have left that reminds me of both of them. That's why every morning, after I remember they're not with me anymore, I hold it and squeeze my eyes shut tight and then open them suddenly to give my eyeballs a surprise. I saw someone on TV do that once to help themselves wake up from a bad dream. But it doesn't work for me, because the picture doesn't change, which means the bad dream isn't a dream at all. But that's not the worst thing about waking up in a foster house. The worst thing is sharing a bed with Noah, and waking up to find that my legs are all cold and sticky because he's wet himself again. I know he can't help it and that he only does it because he's scared, but it's still annoying. I could sleep in the upper bunk bed like I'm supposed to, but then Noah would be all alone. Instead, I try to sleep right on the edge of the bed so that I stay dry, but it never works. I think when my voice comes back, I'm going to ask for an umbrella. So far, Mrs. Oyuchukwu hasn't told Noah off for wetting the bed. Instead, she acts like it's the best thing in the world for anyone to do. Every morning, she comes into our room and says, Rise and shine, sniffing the air like a rabbit. Then she comes to the bed and pulls back the covers and cries out, ah, there it is. As if she's found something special she's been looking for instead of just a big pool of pee. Laughing and waving me and Noah off the bed, she then twirls the wet bedsheet around her arms like a giant roll of candy floss and says, better out than in. First rule of the house. When you need to go, you go.
Lara Sawala narrating The Star Outside My Window by Anjali Q. Ralph. Both The Boy at the Back of the Class and The Star Outside My Window are available commercially as audio, in print, and as ebooks. And if you haven't redeemed your World Book Day voucher yet, there's still time. You've got until the 29th of March to spend it on one of the great titles on offer for £1.
Now it's back to J.M. Joseph for the books of his life. So, Jay, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, when I think of the book that made a big change to me, and well, suggested that maybe I can make it as a writer, I think of The World According to Garp by John Irving. I read that when I was in high school, and it was the first contemporary modern book I read. Up till then, it seemed like I was reading classics the way you do at school, or at least the way I was taught we used to. And it was suggested to me by a teacher in school that this was a marvelous book. And I remember reading it and thinking, first, that this was so funny. I love metafiction. I've always loved metafictional books. The idea of cutting it up and adding other parts from other novels and sticking it in and, you know, talking to the reader about what it is you're trying to do, which I do in my own writing. And I found it very funny. And when I look at Irving's work, I thought it was the first time I looked at a writer and thought, you know, I can do that.
Native intelligence was one of the ways her father had of referring to Garp's dubious genetic background. The Steering School, where Jenny's father and brothers had gone, was at that time an all-boys school. Jenny believed that if she could endure her confinement there, through young Garp's prep school years, she would be doing her best for her son, to make up for denying him a father, as her father put it to her. It's odd, Garp wrote, that my mother, who perceived herself well enough to know that she wanted nothing to do with living with a man, ended up living with 800 boys. So young Garp grew up with his mother in the infirmary annex of the Steering School. He was not exactly treated as a faculty brat, the student's term for all the underage children of the faculty and staff. A school nurse was not considered in quite the same class or category as a faculty member. Moreover, Jenny made no attempt to invent a mythology for Garp's father, to make up a marriage story for herself, to legitimize her son. She was a Fields. She made a point of telling you her name. Her son was a Garp. She made a point of telling you his name. It's his own name, she said. Everyone got the picture. Not only were certain kinds of arrogance tolerated by the society of Steering School, certain kinds were encouraged, but acceptable arrogance was a matter of taste and style. What you were arrogant about had to appear worthy, of higher purpose, and the manner in which you were arrogant was supposed to be charming. Wit did not come naturally to Jenny Fields. Garp wrote that his mother never chose to be arrogant, but was only arrogant under duress. Pride was well loved in the community of the Steering School, but Jenny Fields appeared to be proud of an illegitimate child. Nothing to hang her head about, perhaps. However, she might show a little humility. But Jenny was not only proud of Garp. She was especially pleased with the manner in which she had gotten him. The world did not know that manner, yet. Jenny had not brought out her autobiography. She hadn't begun to write it, in fact. She was waiting for Garp to be old enough to appreciate the story. The story, Garp knew, was all that Jenny would tell anyone who was bold enough to ask. Jenny's story was a sober 3 sentences long. The father of Garp was a soldier. The war killed him. Who took the time for weddings when there was a war? Both the precision and mystery of this story might have been interpreted romantically. After all, given the mere facts, the father might have been a war hero. A doomed love affair could be imagined. Nurse Fields might have been a field nurse. She might have fallen in love at the front. And the father of Garp might have felt he owed one last mission to the men. But Jenny Fields did not inspire the imagination of such a melodrama. For one thing, she seemed too pleased with her aloneness. She didn't appear in the least misty about the past. She was never distracted. She was simply all for little Garp, and for being a good nurse.
James Tillett narrating The World According to Garp by John Irvin, which is TB 8925. It's also available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, I listened to a few of your shows and I listened to some of the authors talking about it. And I think for me, what I will, not so much a book I would reread, but I'm thinking of a book I've reread so many times. I still am a teacher. And of course, you are reading stories to children all the time. The book I enjoyed reading to them the most was The Indian in the Cupboard by Lynn Reed Banks. It was, for me, as an American, opportunity to speak like Little Bull and Boone the Cowboy. I love the idea of having these little toys come alive. This is before Toy Story, of course. And the children used to just love it. It was just a magical moment sharing that story. And the more I read it, year after year, the more I saw into it and realized that it's a story about parenting as much as identity and freedom.
As soon as she had gone, he heard something. A scratching. A muttering. A definitely alive sound coming from the cupboard. Omri snapped his bedside light on. He listened to the sounds, now perfectly clear. Trembling, he turned the key, and there was the Indian, on the shelf this time, almost exactly level with Omri's face, alive again! Again, they stared at each other. Then Omri asked falteringly, "What happened to you?"
"Happen. Good sleep happen. Cold ground. Need blanket. Food. Fire."
Omri was so happy he could scarcely speak. Was the little man giving him orders? Undoubtedly he was. "Okay, you stay there. I'll get food," he gasped as he scrambled out of bed. He hurried downstairs, excited but thoughtful. What could it all mean? It was puzzling, but he didn't bother worrying about it too much. His main concern was to get downstairs without his parents hearing him, find some food that would suit the Indian, and bring it back without anyone asking questions. Fortunately, his parents were watching television, so he was able to tiptoe to the kitchen along the dark passage. Once there, he dared not turn on a light, but there was the fridge light, and that was enough. He surveyed the inside of the fridge. What did Indians eat? Buffalo meat? Rabbits? The sort of animals they could shoot on their prairies. Needless to say, there was nothing like that. Suddenly, his eyes fell on an open tin of sweet corn. He found a paper plate in the drawer where the picnic stuff lived and took a good teaspoon of corn. Then he broke off a crusty corner of bread. Then he thought of some cheese. And what about a drink? Lucky there was a bit of Coke in a big bottle left over from the birthday party, so he took that. Omri sneaked back upstairs with fast-beating heart. All was just as he had left it, except that the Indian was sitting on the edge of the shelf, dangling his legs and trying to sharpen his knife on the metal. He jumped up as soon as he saw Omri.
"Food?"
he asked eagerly. "Yes, but I don't know if it's what you like."
"I like. Give. Quick."
Omri took a pair of scissors and cut a small circle out of the paper plate. On this he put a crumb of bread, another of cheese, and one kernel of the sweet corn. He handed this offering to the Indian, who backed off, looking at the food with hungry eyes, but trying to keep watch on Omri at the same time.
"Not touch. You touch, use knife," he warned.
"All right, I promise not to. Now you can eat." Very cautiously, the Indian sat down. At first, he tried to eat with his left hand, keeping the knife at the ready in his right. But he was so hungry, he soon abandoned this effort, laid the knife close at his side, and grabbing the bread in one hand and the little crumb of cheese in the other, he began to tear at them ravenously. When these two apparently familiar foods had taken the edge off his appetite, he turned his attention to the single kernel of corn.
"What?"
he asked suspiciously. "Corn, like you have," Omri hesitated. "Where you come from?" It was a shot in the dark. He didn't know if the Indian came from anywhere. The Indian grunted, turning the corn about in both hands, for it was half as big as his head. He smelt it. He took a bite. He still looked very suspicious, but he ate and ate. He couldn't finish it, but he evidently liked it.
The inimitable Richard E. Grant narrating The Indian in the Cupboard by Lynn Reed Banks, which is TB 700814.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
The book I would like to recommend to readers is Bear Mouth by Liz Hyder. I picked it up for the first time before Christmas. It just came out. And it blew me away. I bought about 4 or 5 copies and gave them to everyone for Christmas. It's an amazing book written in its own dialect by a character called Newt. In the story, Newt is put into coal mines at the age of 4, where Newt must work. The story, it has so many themes in it, right? From Plato's cave, nearly the whole story is spent in darkness. And it's about learning. She's trying to learn how to read, coming to question the system in which she's been put. And I haven't really read a novel that talked about politics, religion, identity, and reality like that in such wonderful language in many years. I thought it was brilliant.
Bear Mouth by Liz Hyder is available commercially in print and ebook, but unfortunately not yet as an audiobook.
Jem Joseph, thank you so much for sharing your insights into the books that you love with Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much.
Remember, you can share the books of your life by emailing radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for today, but we'll be back at the same time next week. And don't forget, we're also available as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show, to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, which is RedSzell, and producer Robert is at Talking_Books. Farewell until next week and the next chapter of Read On.